Radical change is scary. It's terrifying, actually. And the feminism I support is a full-on revolution, where women are not simply allowed to participate in the world as it already exists, an inherently corrupt world designed by a patriarchy to subjugate and control and destroy all challengers, but are actively able to reshape it. Where women do not simply knock on the doors of churches, of governments, of capitalist marketplaces, and politely ask for admittance, but create their own religious systems, governments, and economies. My feminism is not one of incremental change, revealed in the end to be the same as ever, but more so. It is a cleansing fire. Asking for a system that was built for the express purpose of oppression to, please stop oppressing me, is nonsense work. The only task worth doing is fully dismantling and replacing that system. This is why I cannot associate myself with a feminism that focuses dementedly on self-empowerment, whose goals include not the full destruction of corporate culture, but merely a higher percentage of female CEOs and military officers, a feminism that requires no thought, no discomfort, and no real change. If feminism is universal, if it is something that all women and men can get on board with, then it is not for me. If feminism is nothing more than personal gain disguised as political progress, then it is not for me. If by declaring myself a feminist, I must reassure you that I am not angry, that I pose no threat, then feminism is definitely not for me. I am angry, and I do pose a threat. Hi, I'm Zahn Velines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. As always, I'd like to encourage you, if you like this podcast, to support it by leaving a positive review on your favorite podcast platform, heart reacting it on Substack, and sharing it on social media and with your loved ones. Today's opening vignette comes from Why I Am Not a Feminist, one of five incredible books authored by today's guest, Jessa Crispin. Jessa, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
I'm so delighted to be here. Thank you.
Jessa Crispin is the author of several books, including Why I Am Not a Feminist, A Feminist Manifesto, The Dead Ladies Project, and My Three Dads. She is the editor and founder of The Culture We Deserve, as well as host with Nico Rodriguez of TCWD Weekly Podcast. In 2002, she launched Bookslut.com, one of the first and most treasured literary websites of the era. It ran for 15 years. She is originally from Lincoln, Kansas, and currently lives in Philadelphia. So, Jessa, I think probably the best way for us to get started is you've done so much in so many different areas. So I want to ask you to tell listeners about your work, how you see yourself in feminism, whatever you'd like to tell us.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's a big ask. Listen, I'm just someone who's very curious about the world. And so when I get my teeth into something, I tend to take out a big bite. So yeah, I've written about art, culture, feminism, and now men. I do just want to say about the excerpt that you chose. I think that part is funny, but nobody else thinks it's funny. And I do just want to say, it's not that I meant it as a joke, but when I was referring to myself as a threat, I thought it was funny because I am a, at the time, I was in my 30s making, $25,000 a year and li living in sort of strange, unstable circumstances. So it was funny, but not a joke. So whenever anyone kind of like uses that as a some sort of intro to me, I just want to make it clear, like, it's funny to call myself a threat. I am and I'm not, One only writes a manifesto if they're if they don't actually have any power, and that's where that book was kind of coming from. But yeah.
No, I think I understand what you mean by that. I was at this event last night with another feminist writer who I really love, and she's very nice. She's just a really like nice person, and she kind of answered a question in her like nice way. And then I prefaced my answer to the question with, "Well, now you get mine because I'm not the nice kind of feminist." And And I actually am pretty nice, and I think I'm actually not very threatening, but I do think there's this dynamic in patriarchy where like we're all made out to be threats. And I think that's a bit of what I got from you there, that if you're going to be labeled as a threat, you're just going to kind of claim it.
Yeah, and also, I guess my intention was just to say, I am a very, I do feel like I'm a very kind person, but I don't push around easily. So that's maybe where I was coming from. I'm not going to compromise my values just because it makes you feel better about your shitty values.
Okay, so on that note, I have to tell you how I found you and found why I'm not a feminist. So I was in Barnes and Noble. I was nursing my newborn in the women's study section, and there was this dude like glaring at me. And so I decided to kind of like put a blanket in between him and me and to, very intently look at the women's studies books in the hope that this would terrify him or, I don't know, maybe spark him to say something. And I saw the spine of your book and I was like, oh my God, why am I not a feminist? What the fuck is this shit? And which I love. Like I love that you titled that that way because it got my attention and maybe it wouldn't have otherwise. And I pulled it off the shelf and just immediately started reading it. And I thought, oh, I love this person. I just love her. So I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about that title before you get into anything else, because I think people hear Why I Am Not a Feminist as a book title and they immediately start to get their backs up against the wall, kind of like I did when I started hate reading your book.
Yeah, well, it came out, or I was writing it, I guess, in 2015, and there were a lot of books that were being sort of marketed as feminist material at the time that were just, it was clearly not that, right? It was just clearly lifestyle stuff, clearly just sort of like, yeah, you just call yourself a feminist and you don't have to change anything at all about your behavior, your beliefs, what you want, etc. It's just really important that you use the word. And so I thought, if this is what's being labeled feminist, then clearly any contribution I have to make would not fit under that label. So that's what I was kind of going for. And I know that things have changed somewhat. I don't know that they've changed in substance, but certainly they have rebranded. So that sort of feminism light of just, lifestyle stuff, I don't think really passes anymore. I think we have decided to, as a culture, reject the notion that feminism is just something that you can kind of like call yourself. The stakes are too high now, right? I mean, when the book was published in January of 2017, so I wrote it, before the Donald Trump presidency, and it came out right as he was being sort of sworn into office. And it was like a real shift, like a real change in what people were looking for, what was deemed acceptable to talk about. And there was a real sort of hunger for different ideas. And so, yeah, I guess, yeah, I think I would still call it that. I think I would, if I was putting it out these days, I think I would still kind of label that because there's still a lot of nonsense that's sort of being ushered out under the label of feminism.
Oh, there totally is. I mean, I feel like I kind of agree and disagree with you because I do agree with you that something happened during the Trump presidency and both feminism became more mainstream and lifestyle feminism got more derided, which I think those are both positive things. One thing that I feel like I'm seeing is now this sort of like friendly lifestyle feminism has been transformed into our discourse around like what we expect of men. And what I see in my work, because I mean, my work is just about feminism, but the thing that people say it's about is like household labor, because that's the thing that everybody's talking about right now. And, you know, I write a lot about how relationships are a tool of oppression, and that that's by design, and that men are doing it on purpose to get access to goods and services and all of that. And a lot of men find that like really confrontational. And a lot of women who are writing in this area talk instead about like bumbling nice guys of, oh, they mean well, they just don't know. We just have to teach them. And I kind of feel like that's where the lifestyle feminism stuff has gone, is in this direction of like, well, men don't really want to oppress us. They just have to learn how not to. Do you feel like you see that, or am I crazy?
I do see that. I do see things like that, and I don't know which is I don't I'm not sure which is worse, right? I'm not sure which is worse in the sense of the idea that romance is now supposed to be like a lecture that you give, you know, like one of those videos that you're forced to watch when you get a new job about this is how not to sexually harass your colleagues. Like I feel like there's that element of in feminist discourse of like this is a teaching opportunity. And yeah, and I find that pretty repulsive. But I don't know if the other sort of version of this that I see, which is like the sort of cathartic heteropessimism, hashtag men are a cancer, hashtag men should die. I don't think that's useful either, right? Like there has to be something something else to talk about between those two extremes. But yeah, I definitely get what you're saying as far as the idea that men need to be instructed on a one-on-one basis, and that is going to be what leads us into paradise, is if we just talk to them under the influence of alcohol.
It seems like they mostly want us to talk to men under the influence of the Fair Playbook.
Oh, I hate that thing. I hate
Oh
that
my
thing so
God,
much.
thank
You have
you.
no idea.
Praise be to feminist whatever. I've written a lot about how much I hate that book. It's like become my drumbeat. This idea that, oh, like it's never occurred to women to ask for better, and if we just ask for better, then they'll just like fall in line. It's not political, it's just communication.
Yeah, totally. That's definitely a new idea and not something people have been trying for centuries.
I told my 8-year-old about Fair Play when she was about 6, because I was like writing something about it. And she was like, oh, so like the title of the book should actually be Have You Tried Trying? And I'm just like, yeah,
Aw.
that's it.
Have you tried trying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, no, it's never occurred to us to try for better.
No, never.
So, okay, I think one area where why I'm not a feminist is still relevant, and probably why I excerpted that passage about not being a threat, is I do constantly see this message that feminism is not a threat to men, or is not a threat to capitalism. It's not a threat to anything, and that no one and nothing should be scared. When I had the philosopher Kate Mann on the podcast, we talked a lot about patriarchy as the system of male entitlement, a way for men to get what they want and to enforce the norm that women must give them what they want, and misogyny as like patriarchy's sort of police arm. It's the way that men and the larger system extract things from women. Yet I continuously hear people telling women to just ask nicely and then everything will be fine. We must get nicer and nicer and nicer until we're just asking for nothing at all. And I see this even in like fairly radical feminist circles that we just need to find the right way to ask. Like, why is this so seductive, and why has this become, you know, we see it in Fair Play, but we see it a lot of places.
Yeah, it's funny. Before this book came out, before What Is Wrong with Men came out, the couple years before this, I would talk to different women's groups, feminist organizations, and that sort of thing. And one question that I always knew it was coming, is what do we do about men, right? Like, what do we do about their failure to recognize us, to listen to us, to take seriously our demands? And my answer was always, provide for yourself. I mean, romantically, sexually, obviously there are there are some things you can't just do on your own. And it's inconvenient and expensive to build a life outside of heterosexual normativity, right? So I'm not in any way just sort of dismissing the difficulty that comes with figuring things out on your own. And yet, the idea of waiting, of delaying, of making yourself smaller or more acceptable or whatever, it doesn't work. It's not going to lead to anything. So if there's something that you really need or want in your life, the best way forward is to figure out how to provide it for yourself or for each other, as in with other women.
I love
Now,
that.
if you need men for things, and we need men for some things, we need men for certain political goals. We need men for, there are institutions run by men, countries run by men that we have to engage with and through in order to attain certain goals. That's fine. But we need to figure out how to create political, social solidarity that is not reliant on some sort of fantasy that they have to see us, hear us, etc. That idea that we need to be in perfect harmony in order to work together, in order to get anything done, it's not going to happen. And it's a fool's errand and it is a waste of time and energy. But that doesn't mean you can't work with somebody, right? Even if ultimately you have some sort of understanding that they see you as lesser, that doesn't mean that those people can't be useful. And so I think, there's so much energy wasted on the left in trying to come to consensus. You don't need consensus, you need solidarity. What you can get on your own that is wonderful, you need to find some way of recognizing that and acknowledging it and providing it for yourselves or within a group. But the things that you need to collaborate on, it doesn't require consensus. And I know that it's uncomfortable. I know it's gnarly and it feels shitty to work with people who don't see you as fully human or who just don't think of you at all. But that's how things get done. And I get very frustrated with this insistence that men need to be on some sort of level. No, you just need them to give you some things. And you need to give them some things. And then you go on your merry fucking way and you don't have to deal with this anymore.
This is incredible wisdom. And I love it that you've said this. I have a couple of questions, and this is going to go in a different direction than I originally planned it going. So you'll just have to bear with me. So I have become really obsessed with trying to understand this thing we do on the left, where we're focused on consensus and feelings and often quite reactive to disagreement rather than strategic. I've written a lot about it, and I mostly feel like I'm just kind of like eating my own tail in thinking about it.
Sure.
Can you say a little bit more about building solidarity versus building consensus? Can you just speak more to this issue and kind of like what you envision?
Yeah, I mean, solidarity is the acknowledgement that you have shared interests, shared goals, and you will fight together in order to attain those goals and meet those interests. But when that comes to something like healthcare reform, does it matter? Does it matter that they think of you as lesser? Does it matter that they think of you as useful? Whatever. No, I don't think that it does. And I think that the reason why the so-called left in the United States is so focused on consensus is because that there has never actually really been in over 100 years a real political left in the United States. There's been a centrist movement, but as far as like a real investment in class, investment in workers, investment in the material resources, and their distribution, we don't have that, and we haven't had it in a very long time. And also, the political left in the United States has never had power, the real power, as far as a presidency or some sort of significant presence in leadership. And so we just don't actually know how to do this. We don't know how to do this in the way that other countries do know how to do this because they have been doing this for hundreds of years. And I think that Americans like to think of themselves as like, I'm sort of including Canadians in this, but we like to think of ourselves as like wholly self-sufficient. We have all the best ideas. We know how to do everything, when that's not true. And we are so hesitant to learn from others, for the same reason that men are hesitant to learn from us, because we see the rest of the world as lower on the hierarchy. We don't like to associate with people lower on the hierarchy because then what if we are, what if our position shifts downward to meet them? And so the United States does not experience solidarity with the feminists of Colombia that have had real serious material successes as far as reproductive rights and so on. We just don't. And we have so much to learn from them in the same way that men have so much to learn from us. But they don't, no one likes to humble themselves and no one likes to associate with anybody lower than them. And so it's kind of a shame. And I think that that's why we get in these sort of self-defeatist cycles, is because we actually don't know how to do this work.
I mean, that's kind of how it feels to me. Like, whether it's me doing something, writing something by myself, or like engaging with other activists, I often just feel like I actually don't know how to do this. I actually don't know what I'm doing. And instead, what I'm engaging in is a competition with other people to like convince each other that we know how to do something we have no fucking idea how to do.
Sure. And, especially in an environment where it's so easy to see, we're so incentivized to see everyone around us as our competitor and not our collaborator. And that's how we get into these messes because it's like we will find any excuse not to work with somebody, including, oh, they disrespected me, so they're dead to me. But that's what it is. Like that's why the left get in the United States gets into these cycles because ultimately they don't want to be working with anybody else. They want to compete. They don't want to collaborate, and so they just find ways of self-sabotage, in order to avoid the trickiness of collaboration, the compromise of it.
It's, I mean, I think a lot of it is like emotional control. Like we don't have the, we don't have the emotional control to just work with others. Okay, so let's switch gears and talk about your latest book, What Is Wrong with Men? Patriarchy, the Crisis of Masculinity, and How, of course, Michael Douglas Films Explain Everything. Tell me about this wild, wacky ride of a book you have written.
Well, during the pandemic, there was the cancel culture discourse, the toxic masculinity discourse, the whole Me Too resurgence, all happening primarily on social media because no one could see anyone face to face. nobody could like organize in the material realm. And so we were just having wild conversations online that did absolutely nothing. And so I felt so alienated from the takeover that this was having on feminist discourse, and so discouraged by it. And then I was just like, I'm just going to watch Basic Instinct like 18 times. And then
God.
over the next 3 days,
What does that do to a person's brain?
it's so healing. It's like a spa treatment. It's such a beautiful movie about killing men that you don't like. And yeah, I mean it's a wonderful movie of, heteropessimism and the failures of true liberation, right? So I was watching Basic Instinct a lot. And as, the discourse was happening around cancellation and toxicity and what are we going to do with men and all of this kind of stuff, I found that oddly, the Michael Douglas movies, instead of becoming an escape from it, was helping me think about it in a slightly different way. And part of that was just that I love Michael Douglas. I have infinite resources of love and affection for Michael Douglas. But on screen, right, he's a mess. He's a mess. He's a jerk. He's a sex pest. He's a rapist. He is a misogynist. He is the worst person in the entire world. And I was trying to figure out how to maintain that level of affection and love for somebody as they were sort of flailing and acting out, if that makes any sense. So when I decided I wanted to write about men, Michael Douglas became a useful figure to me to like hang all of my empathy on, in order to keep in mind that there's men, right? There's men, men, boo, boo, men. Men are bad. Men are a cancer. All men should die. All those hashtags and all of that. That's fine. But then there are men as individuals, as flawed human beings, as people who have dignity, who are worthy of empathy and love. And so, how do you mesh the two of those? How do you combine them without one overtaking the other? And so I decided to do it by writing about Michael Douglas.
I love that. I also I should warn you that like every podcast episode when I post it, I begin it with a quote. And I really think it's such a beautiful movie about killing men. really needs to be yours. I have to confess that I have never seen Basic Instinct.
Oh my God, you have to. It's so good. It's so good. That was the first movie that made me think that there was a whole book there, right? Because the more I watched it, the more I noticed things like every single woman in that movie is a murderer of men. Every single woman in that movie has murdered a husband, a father, a brother, a boyfriend, someone,
Really?
in it as an act of liberation. Yes, literally every single female character who gets, who has a name, who's not just in the background dancing. Although you don't know, maybe they're murderers too. They don't get into it. But every single woman in that movie is a murderer.
That's amazing.
And when I noticed that, like the whole thing just sort of like unlocked for me. So yeah, it's an amazing movie.
Okay, well, so we, my partner and I almost never watch movies because anytime that we say, hey, let's watch a movie, then like it's pretty much guaranteed that we're going to end up fighting because we can't decide on a movie. And then we get upset
Sure.
that we can't decide on a movie. And then like we've wasted the whole night. And then it's like, well, another night ruined by not a. So you may have saved us. We'll watch Basic Instinct and see how it goes. So this is an 80s movie, right?
No,
Late 80s,
90s,
90s.
1990s.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's very sort of it sort of marks the tone from 80s to 90s, right? Because the
Yeah.
80s was this career woman version of feminism, right? If we just go to the colleges, if we just enter the businesses, if we just, we'll just lean in, we'll just get through it, we'll power through it, and we're gonna be allowed to have power and get what we want and et cetera, et cetera. And then the beginning of the 90s, it was like, okay, well, that didn't work out, because we discovered things like sexual harassment, things like being catcalled on the streets, things like having our abortion doctors assassinated, these sorts of things that were obstacles to actual liberation. Liberation seemed possible, but actually getting to it turned out to be not workable. And so you see like this turn from sort of the tail end of second wave feminism into the birth of third wave feminism. And third wave feminism is much more conflicted, ambivalent, much more sort of focused on both very mundane things, like self-presentation, and very horrific things like, can you please stop blowing up our abortion clinics? Can you please stop raping us? Can you please, all of that stuff. And the direction of the energy just changed so fast. And that Basic Instinct is kind of that moment of this turn of like, well, what if they just die? What if instead of us just trying to achieve and finding ourselves constantly thwarted and pushed back, what if they just go away? What if they just weren't in existence anymore? And that's the kind of tone of Basic Instinct.
Yeah. So, okay. The subtitle of your section on Basic Instinct is titled, "What if we just got rid of all of the men?" So, I mean, well, not that I'm suggesting this. I have many individual men that I love. Men as a class, I don't feel great about though. But like, what if we did? I think a large number of my readers and listeners like really believe that men are basically irredeemable, and that patriarchy will never end, like as long as we have men. Tell me what you think about that. I mean, you posed the question.
Yeah, well, I think actually patriarchy no longer exists. And I think that that's been true since the 1970s. And what we, I guess I should get, I should be more specific about
But
that.
tell me what you mean by that.
So the idea of the patriarchy is a way of ruling society where rights, resources, and access to institutions are limited exclusively to men. And those rights, resources, et cetera, flow through men, through a system of inheritance. That no longer exists because of feminism, because we now have the right to vote. We now have the right to own property. We now have the right to earn money. We now get access to the institutions like education, religion, et cetera. We are in a kind of zombie patriarchy where it kind of looks like patriarchy, but it doesn't function the same way. And I think that that's why everything is so confusing. Because men do not necessarily hold power in the way that they used to, in the sense of it being automatic. And women have access to more resources and more power than they ever have, right? For thousands of years. Basically, since we have had written language, we've had patriarchy. So there's no real rule book for how a shift like this is supposed to go. And I think we're kind of like freaking out about it, which, fair. But I think that the reason why I'm so stubborn in saying this is because it sort of like lets everybody off the hook. If we say that patriarchy still exists, then that allows men to think that they're still in control when they're not. And if we let women say that we live under patriarchy, then they don't really have to take responsibility for the way they use the power that they do have. And I think ultimately, this is why we have a sort of culture of such nostalgia, because we understood what patriarchy was, how it operated, how to function under it. We don't really know how things are right now. We don't really know how to manage it, how to adapt to it. And so then we're just kind of pretending like this other system is in place when it's not, because at least that makes us feel like we know what's going on. So yeah, I think it's an important point, because if we're gonna sort of improve our situations politically, personally, et cetera, I think it's very important to understand what exactly we are up against. And the patriarchy just isn't quite it. It's ruled by men, but not necessarily patriarchy. It's different.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so one of the things that I argue that seems kind of relevant to this is maybe I'm weighing how I feel about this assertion that like patriarchy doesn't really exist anymore. So it's kind of like distracting me. But you know, there's not a lot of formalized, legalized oppression so much anymore. It factually exists, but it legally does not exist. And so one of the ways that whatever system we have right now continues to control women is through heterosexual relationships, and especially heterosexual relationships that involve children. And like one of the ways that we see this happen so commonly is men as shitty parents and shitty partners who then, you know, weaponize the children to keep the woman and keep access to her services because she's afraid for him to have custody of children that he's not really fit to care for. So, and I think that this is kind of like really obvious to anybody who pays attention that this is happening. And I think anybody who looks around them can see that most of these relationships are unhappy and that they limit the woman's freedom and limit her opportunities and all of that. And yet, women keep willingly entering these relationships. And I just don't understand why that's happening. Can you help me understand it?
By these types of relationships, you mean heterosexual relationships or abusive relationships?
I kind of am using the same interchangeably, or using the two interchangeably, because I think that most heterosexual marriages are at least exploitive. And I see women entering these relationships without, you know, much vetting, without a lot of caution, and, you know, often overlooking glaring red flags. I do think that marriage remains a key tool of women's oppression, and yet we just like jump right into it. Like, what is this?
I want to skip backward just a little bit, because I got so distracted in saying the patriarchy no longer existed that I didn't answer the actual question that you asked me, which was, why can't we just get rid of all the men? I mean, this is what everybody has thought throughout time, right? If I just eliminate everybody who disagrees with me, I will have created utopia. That it doesn't work. That doesn't work. I do wish that women were more imaginative, in figuring out how to set up their lives outside of needing men's approval or needing material resources from men, whatever it is that they're getting. But I also know that it is an unbearably difficult project to establish a life outside of marriage, the family, the institutions, etc. For God, 40 years, I guess 20 years as an adult, or therefore, I tried to live outside of family, marriage, institutions. And basically, what we did when we sort of liberated women out of patriarchy was we dumped them into the marketplace, right? At a disadvantage, because men have had the money and the power for centuries, millennia. And so then when we all sort of landed in the middle of the marketplace, we didn't know what we were doing for the most part. Or we didn't know, we were just at a disadvantage. We just weren't up to speed. We weren't in control. Whatever. But if you want to live a life, if you want to build a career, have a family, whatever, outside of the patriarchal form of the nuclear family, the heterosexual relationship, etc., then you had better have the money to replace everything that the family provides, because the family provides a lot. The family, the father, the husband provides material resources, emotional resources, social resources that are extremely difficult and expensive to provide for your own self. As in, if you get married, you get access to things, depending on your situation, you get access to things like immigration assistance, healthcare assistance, family planning assistance, estate planning assistance. Then there are the intangible things of your father helps you figure out how to navigate the world. So if you don't have a father, or you don't have like a good father, and this is biological, this is metaphorical, however you want to sort of understand father here, then you have to figure this out all out on your own. You don't get an entry, you don't get the legacy entry into Harvard. You don't get the introduction to the head of the bank at the party, et cetera. You have to make your own way. And the way that you make your way in today's society is through money. So that's why people marry. That's why people get married. That's why people date. That's why we stay in these forms, because they bring reward. And not everybody has the resources or the ability to construct an entire self and an entire life outside of these forms. It's very expensive. There was a moment when I was, it was about six months before I turned 40 years old. I was lying in the emergency room. It was 3 a.m. And, there was like a man, I guess, like transforming into a werewolf in the room next door. I didn't know, I couldn't see what was happening, but that's what I assumed was happening, because I was on a lot of morphine. And because I was on a lot of morphine, I like posted something on Instagram. And the man that I had been involved in for like in involved with for like 7 years, I guess at this point, liked my post, but like didn't text to see what was going on, And I was like, oh, I'm on my own. And I was like, I have to change my life. And that was sort of that moment of like, my scrappy existence isn't scrappy. It's kind of pathetic. I need to figure something else out. But I had tried, for 20 years to live a life outside of these forms, and it didn't really, I didn't have the money to back it up. I didn't have the money to navigate anything or create anything on my own.
That's a really harsh reality. I capitalism brutality. I don't even know what to say to that. So I guess one thing I would ask you about that is I get a lot of younger 20-something women kind of asking me for advice and guidance, like how do I build a life in this, misogynistic, capitalistic hellscape? What would you tell them?
I mean, I guess I would tell them that I would always make a plea for treating other people with dignity and with decency and sincerity, but that is not going to that will actively get in the way of paying the bills, right? That what our society wants from you in order to succeed is diametrically opposed to what creates goodness, what creates character, and what makes a life worth living, really. And that the task is an impossible one because it's balancing those two demands. And it's very tempting and will make your life much easier if you decide to just go all in with seeing everyone around you as your competitor and seeing your own sort of bank account growth and career goals being met as success, as the ultimate form of a good life. And whatever benzos or cocktails you have to take in order to quiet the little voice that comes out at 3 a.m. that says, I don't know about this. This doesn't seem great. I feel like maybe there's something missing here. Like that's just part of the toll that's paid for that kind of life. But I would say that a life of meaning is always now and has always been an extremely difficult one, a one that will put you in direct conflict with what other people want from you, including the people who love you, but that it is an essential task. And even if you only do it for a couple of years, it's still worth doing.
I really like that. I really think that's wonderful, beautiful, pessimistic, and optimistic advice. I think that's the best anybody can offer. So thank you for that. All right, going back to your book. So your last section of your book is kind of talking about where we are now with the rise of like the male influencer, these like incel bro monsters. Okay, so what's wrong with men now? Like what's wrong with these guys? What's going on?
So basically, there's this do you know the writer Robert J. Lifton?
Yes.
Yeah, he wrote about cults. And one of the major points he made is that the person who is the most susceptible to a cult leader or to some sort of like fake guru or con man grifter is a person without a father. And again, like father means both biological and metaphorical, like some sort of influence in a person's life that tells you how to navigate the world. And essentially, we have a couple generations of men who do not have useful fathers, fathers that are useful to them in the sense that can help them understand how the world operates and how to create a life for themselves within the world, how to create a life that is both lacking in instability and has some sort of larger meaning to it. And that's because the way you used to, well, I mean, that's because the patriarchy is over, right? And if you're sort of working, if you were raised within the sort of golden era of the patriarchy when things really worked for you, and you understood what the values of patriarchy were, what patriarchy wanted from you, and what it would give you in return, then you don't really have anything to say to somebody who is not living under that form of patriarchy. The values of patriarchy are over, right? The idea of stewardship, the idea of loyalty, that's for suckers now. What patriarchy wants from you, as far as respectability, conformity, delayed gratification, very specific sort of goals and education and career, that's no longer there. There's no stable path for anybody except for the mega rich. And so everybody's sort of looking around in these younger generations, having been told the world is one way and it operates in a completely different kind of way, and they're looking for guidance. And there are a lot of men online who are willing to do the grift, willing to lie to their followers, either intentionally or unknowingly, and say, this is what's wrong with the world, and this is how you get ahead in the world. And part of the problem is that we have a mass media, we have a culture, whatever, that also doesn't understand really how the world works. We have a sort of political system that is not responsive to its citizens, to the people it's supposed to be representing. And there's no way to sort of really organize under the current conditions in order to achieve goals. And so a lot of people are suffering and they're told that they're doing fine, right? We have like 65% of the nation now doesn't make enough money to meet basic needs every month. And we have people who go on CNN and other news programs and say, you know, the economy is booming, unemployment is down, everything is wonderful. And so if you're feeling that disconnect and you have two broken legs and four broken ribs and et cetera, and you're being told to walk it off, or that you're performing, you're exaggerating your pain. You're going to be very receptive to somebody who says, I can see that you are bleeding. I can see that you're in pain. I can see you're suffering. And you're like, okay, you have my attention. And then they follow it up with, and you know what caused that? Feminism. So, you know, like they are just so desperate for someone to just say and agree with them that they are in a bad way, that they become receptive to people telling them they know how to fix their problems, because none of those guys do, right? Andrew Tate doesn't know. Jordan Peterson doesn't know. Scott Galloway, bless his heart, he does not know. But they think they have some sort of idea, and they think that they know what's going on, and they don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I am constantly trying to tell people is like it does suck for men. It just doesn't suck for them because of women, and it doesn't necessarily suck for them more than it sucks for us, which is like the real message that seems to resonate with them, that it's worse for men than anybody else.
Well, I think that it's worse for poor men than it's worse for most people. I do think that, I mean, it's useless to kind of put everything on a scale and say, oh, this pain, we're going to give that a 2.8 and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That's useless.
Yeah.
But as far as who's dying younger, who's suffering more addiction, who's failing to find employment, who's failing to meet employment goals, it's young, poor men, right? That's who it is. And who's experiencing the most violence, who's experiencing the most pain, physical and otherwise, it's young, poor men. And so it's part of the problem is that, or the reason why their anger gets misdirected at women is partly because they're told that this is a patriarchy, and so they should be in control. They should have positions of power. Women should be under them, and they're not, right? And also part of it is that women have created organizations and support systems and institutions through, you know, feminism to assist women in building their lives. And so they are actually in a better position socially. They have more outlets, they have more places to go, people to talk to. they know the skills of living in contemporary life as far as, being able to relate to others better than men do. And so they see women doing better than them, even if it's partly fantasy. And they're manipulated, they're told by so many men, like Jordan Peterson, like Andrew Tate, that this is an unnatural state of events, that this is an unnatural ordering of the world, and that things need to be put right. Women need to be put in their place, et cetera. I am not, when I talk about these things, in any way suggesting that men do not have some responsibility to see through the bullshit. And yet, I can see and understand how they get trapped in these things. I can see and understand how they get trapped in grievance culture, and in these kinds of gurus, because I see it within women's culture as well. And so I can spot it when they're doing it too.
All right. Well, that's a lot for everyone to think about. So I have one final question for you that's kind of like switching gears away from feminism and masculinity and all of that, because you did found Book Slut and you are kind of a literary guru, even if you won't claim it and don't love literary culture. Can you give some book recommendations for listeners?
Oh God. I mean, that's like a
Not to put you on the spot.
that's a big ask.
Okay, what are you reading right now? How about that?
I am reading Lost Illusions by Balzac. It's kind of funny. I have been at the Culture We Deserve, we've been doing a 19th century novel book club, pivoting around the 1848 revolutions. And I had been thinking a lot about 1848 in the sense that it's kind of the birthplace of feminism, really, as like a organized political movement. And you can see the beginning stages of women trying to figure out how to conceptualize themselves as political figures and to fi try to figure out, because it hadn't been done before, what are the actual things that would improve their lives, that it would improve their political standing, improve their daily existences. And it was hard to figure out. And there was a lot of like guessing. There was a lot of crazy manifestos, a lot of, weird input from fringe figures. But it was interesting and fun and exciting because you can see people thinking for the first time as a whole, as a collaborative effort. Okay, what is it that we actually want and we feel like we can ask for and that we can move toward thinking that we deserve, right? If you've been thinking of yourself as not a political figure for a long time, it's hard to conceptualize yourself in that way. And so it's exciting. But 1848 was also a series of failed revolutions. Uprisings that were put down very harshly, very violently. Thousands of people died all across Europe. And yet it was also like a spontaneous, kind of contagious effort across the continent, and not just in Europe, but in other countries too. This uprising of people saying, actually, you know what? Fuck monarchy. We want something else. And we're not sure what it is yet, but we have guns, and so you have to listen to us. And then a lot of them died. But I've been interested because we are in our time in a kind of state of failed revolution, right? Revolutions that never get off the ground, that fail to find common goals, that fail to come up with a sort of coherent plan of how things could be better. And so I find a lot of inspiration in 1848, even though it ended in disaster. And even though it ended in disaster, it was also the beginning point of feminism, of different civil rights, of universal suffrage. All of these sorts of efforts come from failure, and I find that very inspiring and very interesting. And so I'm reading Lost Solutions by Balzac, but we've also read The Red and the Black by Stendhal, and The Last Man by Mary Shelley, which is maybe my favorite novel of all time. So I guess I would say Last Man by Mary Shelley, which is about a bunch of people trying to figure out how to politically reorganize the world, and then everybody dies.
I
But
can
that
echo
doesn't,
that recommendation. It's really, really good.
yeah, because the fact that they died doesn't mean that they wasted their time trying to figure out how to live. And that is what's so beautiful about it, right? Painfully beautiful. And yeah, I'm having a really good time thinking about 1848. So also Revolutionary Spring by Christopher Clark, which is a big fat history of 1848. Excellent, excellent book.
So I'm like fascinated by this idea lately that the things we do, and especially the activist and philosophical things that we do, have to succeed and have to succeed immediately to be worthwhile. And, the reality is that if we get free at all, we do it over many generations of many failures, and we often go backwards. And I think the last, I think Mary Shelley is just a good, like, emblematic of this. So, yeah. But also, I want to draw your attention to the fact that I asked for a book recommendation and it ended in a discussion of revolution, which I just think is like perfect for a conversation with you.
Well, it's in the air, you know. It's always in the discourse. It's hard to have a conversation about anything without somebody suggesting that we overthrow the government.
This is true. This is true. But it's especially in your discourse, which is why I love your work and one of the reasons that I think listeners will love your work. And also your Substack, which I just discovered this week, and everyone should go subscribe immediately. I'll put it in the show notes, and I'll put all of Jess's information in the show notes. She has so much stuff out there. You could just devote like an entire class to Jess's work, which I
Oh, God.
love. Yeah. So, Jessa, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You've just
Of
been
course.
wonderful and amazing.
I really appreciate the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So subscribe to Jessa, read her books, support her, let us know what you think, and I will be back with everyone in 2 weeks.